Chapter 8. Conjugated Greek text omitted, and that their school learning carried them not as far as the letter, but only to the game of Ta. How were they to be inspired by such subjects? From having seen Thelma and Mademoiselle Georges flaunting in sham Greek costumes, and having read up the articles Eudemidas, Hecuba, in the mythological dictionary. What a classicism, inspired by Rouge, gas lamps, and a few lines in Lempriere, and copied, half from ancient statues, and half from a naked guardsman at 1 shilling and 6 pence the hour. Delacroix is a man of a very different genius, and his Eddie is a genuine creation of a noble fancy. For most of the others, Mrs. Brownrigg, and her two female apprentices, would have done as well as the desperate Colchian with her Greek text omitted. M. Delacroix has produced a number of rude, barbarous pictures. But there is the stamp of genius on all of them, the great poetical intention, which is worth all your execution. Delarich is another man of high merit, with not such a great art, perhaps, as the other, but a fine and careful draftsman, and an excellent arranger of his subject. The Death of Elizabeth is a raw young performance, seemingly not, at least, to my taste. The Fan's Dead Hour is renowned over Europe, and has appeared in 100 different ways in print. It is properly pathetic and gloomy, and merits fully its high reputation. This painter rejoices in such subjects in what Lord Portsmouth used to call lack jobs. He has killed Charles I, and Lady Jane Grey, and the Dukes of Guise, and I don't know whom besides. He is, at present, occupied with a vast work at the Beaux-Arts, where the writer of this had the honor of seeing him, a little, keen-looking man, some 5 feet in height. He wore, on this important occasion, a bandana round his head, and was in the act of smoking a cigar. Horace Vernet, whose beautiful daughter Delarich married, is the king of French battle painters and amazingly rapid and dexterous draftsman, who has Napoleon and all the campaigns by heart, and has painted the Grenadier Francais under all sorts of attitudes. His pictures on such subjects are spirited, natural, and excellent. And he is so clever a man, that all he does, is good to a certain degree. His Judith is somewhat violent, perhaps. His Rebecca most pleasing, and not the less so for a little pretty affectation of attitude and needless singularity of costume. Apel and Michelangelo is as clever a picture as can be clever is just the word, the groups and drawing excellent, the coloring pleasantly bright and gaudy, and the French students study it incessantly. There are a dozen who copy it for one who copies Delacroix. His little scraps of woodcuts, in the now publishing Life of Napoleon, are perfect gems in their way, and the noble price paid for them not a penny more than he merits. The picture, by Court, of The Death of Caesar, is remarkable for effect and excellent workmanship. And the head of Brutus, who looks like Armand Carrel, is full of energy. There are some beautiful heads of women, and some very good color in the picture. Jacqueline's Eth of Adelaide de Comminges is neither more nor less than beautiful. Adelaide had, it appears, a lover, who betook himself to a convent of Trappists. She followed him thither, disguised as a man, took the vows, and was not discovered by him till on her deathbed. The painter has told this story in a most pleasing and affecting manner. The picture is full of unction and melancholy grace. The objects, too, are capitally represented, and the tone and color very good. Decazen's Guardian Angel is not so good in color, but is equally beautiful in expression and grace. A little child and a nurse are asleep. An angel watches the infant. You see, women look very wistfully at this sweet picture. And what triumph would a painter have more? We must not quit the Luxembourg without noticing the dashing sea pieces of Gouden, and one or two landscapes by Giraux, the plain of Krasavodin, and the Prometheus of Aligny. This is an imitation, perhaps, as is a noble picture of Jesus Christ and the children, by Flandrin. But the artists are imitating better models, at any rate, and one begins to perceive that the odious classical dynasty is no more. Poussin's magnificent Elifimus, I only know a print of that marvelous composition, has, perhaps, suggested the first named picture, and the latter has been inspired by a good enthusiastic study of the Roman schools. Of this revolution, Monsieur Ingres has been one of the chief instruments. He was, before Horace Vernet, president of the French Academy at Rome, and is famous as a chief of a school. When he broke up his atelier here, to set out for his presidency, many of his pupils attended him faithfully some way on his journey, and some, with scarcely a penny in their pouches, walked through France and across the Alps in a pious pilgrimage to Rome, being determined not to forsake their old master. Such an action was worthy of them, and of the high rank which their profession holds in France, where the honors to be acquired by art are only inferior to those which are gained in war. One reads of such peregrinations in old days, when the scholars of some great Italian painter followed him from Venice to Rome, or from Florence to Ferrara. In regard of Ingres' individual merit as a painter, the writer of this is not a fair judge, having seen but three pictures by him, one being a plafond in the Louvre, which his disciples much admire. Ingres stands between the Imperio Davido classical school of French art, and the namby-pamby mystical German school, which is for carrying us back to Cranach and Durer, and which is making progress here. For everything here finds imitation. The French have the genius of imitation and caricature. This absurd humbug, called the Christian or Catholic art, is sure to tickle our neighbors, and will be a favorite with them, when better known. My dear McGilp, I do believe this to be a greater humbug than the humbug of David and Girardet, inasmuch as the latter was founded on nature at least, whereas the former is made up of silly affectations and improvements upon nature. Here, for instance, is Chevalier Ziegler's picture of Saint Luke painting the Virgin. Saint Luke has a monk's dress on, embroidered, however, smartly round the sleeves. The Virgin sits in an immense yellow ochre halo, with her son in her arms. She looks preternaturally solemn, as does Saint Luke, who is eyeing his paintbrush with an intense ominous mystical look. They call this Catholic art. There is nothing, my dear friend, more easy in life. First take your colors, and rub them down clean bright carmine, bright yellow, bright sienna, bright ultramarine, bright green. Make the costumes of your figures as much as possible like the costumes of the early part of the 15th century. Paint them in with the above colors, and if on the gold ground, the more Catholic your art is. Dress your apostles like priests before the altar, and remember to have a good commodity of croziers, censers, and other such gimcracks, as you may see in the Catholic chapels, in Sutton Street and elsewhere. Deal in virgins, and dress them like a burgomaster's wife by Cranach or Van Eyck. Give them all long twisted tails to their gowns, and proper angular draperies. Plus all their heads on one side, with the eyes shut, and the proper solemn simper. At the back of the head, draw, and gild with gold leaf, a halo or glory, of the exact shape of a cartwheel. And you have the thing done. It is Catholic art out cratch, as Louis Philippe says. We have it still in England, handed down to us for four centuries, in the pictures on the cards, as the redoubtable king and queen of clubs. Look at them. You will see that the costumes and attitudes are precisely similar to those which figure in the Catholicities of the school of Overbeck and Cornelius. Before you take your cane at the door, look for one instant at the statue room. Yonder is Jowfley's Unfil Confiant Son Premier Secret a Venus. Charming, charming. It is from the exhibition of this year only, and I think the best sculpture in the gallery pretty, fanciful, naive, admirable in workmanship and imitation of nature. I have seldom seen flesh better represented in marble. Examine, also, Jolly's Udur, Jackwood's Imp, and Rootzoy with the Tortoise. These are not very exalted subjects, or what are called exalted, and do not go beyond simple, smiling beauty and nature. But what then? Are we gods, Milton's, Michelangelo's, that can leave Earth when we please, and soar to heights immeasurable? No, my dear McGilp, but the fools of academicians would fain make us so. Are you not, and half the painters in London, panting for an opportunity to show your genius in a great historical picture? Oh, blind race! Have you wings? Not a feather. And yet you must be ever puffing, sweating up to the tops of rugged hills, and, arrived there, clapping and shaking your ragged elbows, and making as if you would fly. Come down, silly Daedalus. Come down to the lowly places in which nature ordered you to walk. The sweet flowers are springing there, the fat muttons are waiting there, the pleasant sun shines there. Be content and humble, and take your share of the good cheer. While we have been indulging in this discussion, the omnibus has gaily conducted us across the water, and La Garde Cui Vale La Porte du Louvre ni defend pas our entry. What a paradise this gallery is for French students, or foreigners who sojourn in the capital. It is hardly necessary to say that the brethren of the brush are not usually supplied by fortune with any extraordinary wealth, or means of enjoying the luxuries with which Paris, more than any other city, abounds. But here they have a luxury which surpasses all others, and spend their days in a palace which all the money of all the Rothschilds could not buy. They sleep, perhaps, in a garret, and dine in a cellar, but no grandee in Europe has such a drawing room. King's houses have, at best, but damask hangings, and gilt cornices. What are these to a wall covered with canvas by Paul Veronese, or 100 yards of Rubens? Artists from England, who have a national gallery that resembles a moderate-sized gin shop, who may not copy pictures, except under particular restrictions, and on rare and particular days, may revel here to their heart's content. Here is a room half a mile long, with as many windows as Aladdin's palace, open from sunrise till evening, and free to all manners and all varieties of study. The only puzzle to the student is to select the one he shall begin upon, and keep his eyes away from the rest. Fontaine's grand staircase, with its arches, and painted ceilings and shining Doric columns, leads directly to the gallery, but it is thought too fine for working days, and is only opened for the public entrance on Sabbath. A little back stair leading from a court, in which stand numerous bas-reliefs, and a solemn sphinx, of polished granite, is the common entry for students and others, who, during the week, enter the gallery. Hither have lately been transported a number of the works of French artists, which formerly covered the walls of the Luxembourg. Death only entitles the French painter to a place in the Louvre, and let us confine ourselves to the Frenchman only, for the space of this letter. I have seen, in a fine private collection at Saint Germain, one or two admirable single figures of David, full of life, truth, and gaiety. The color is not good, but all the rest excellent, and one of these, so much lauded pictures is the portrait of a washerwoman. Pope Pius, at the Louvre, is as bad in color as remarkable for its vigor and look of life. The man had a genius for painting portraits and common life, but must attempt the heroic, failed signally, and what is worse, carried a whole nation blundering after him. Had you told a Frenchman so, 20 years ago, he would have thrown the dementi in your teeth, or, at least, laughed at you in scornful incredulity. They say of us, that we don't know when we are beaten. They go a step further, and swear their defeats are victories. David was a part of the glory of the empire, and one might as well have said then that Amulus was a bad picture, as that Toulouse was a lost battle. Old-fashioned people, who believe in the emperor, believe in the theater Francais, and believe that Ducis improved upon Shakespeare, have the above opinion. Still, it is curious to remark, in this place, how art and literature become party matters, and political sects have their favorite painters and authors. Nevertheless, Jacques-Louis David is dead. He died about a year after his bodily demise in 1825. The romanticism killed him. Walter Scott, from his castle of Abbotsford, sent out a troop of gallant young Scotch adventurers, merry outlaws, valiant knights, and savage Highlanders, who, with drunk hosen and buff jerkins, fierce two-handed swords, and harness on their back, did challenge, combat, and overcome the heroes and demigods of Greece and Rome. Notre Dame Larry Scouse. Sir Brian de Bois Gilbert has borne Hector of Troy clear out of his saddle. Andromache may weep, but her spouse is beyond the reach of physic. See, Robin Hood twangs his bow, and the heathen gods fly, howling. Montjoy St. Denis. Down goes Ajax under the mace of Dunois, and yonder are Leonidas and Romulus begging their lives of Rob Roy MacGregor. Classicism is dead. Sir John Froissart has taken Dr. Lempriere by the nose, and reigns sovereign. Of the great pictures of David the defunct, we need not, then, say much. Romulus is a mighty fine young fellow, no doubt, and if he has come out to battle stark naked, except a very handsome helmet, it is because the costume became him, and shows off his figure to advantage. But was there ever anything so absurd as this passion for the nude, which was followed by all the painters of the Davidian epoch? And how are we to suppose yonder straddle to be the true characteristic of the heroic and the sublime? Romulus stretches his legs as far as ever nature will allow. The Horatii, in receiving their swords, think proper to stretch their legs to, and to thrust forward their arms, thus. Drawing omitted, Romulus's is in the exact action of a telegraph, and the Horatii are all in the position of the lunge. Is this the sublime? Mr. Angelo, of Bond Street, might admire the attitude. His namesake, Michelle, I don't think would. The little picture of Iris and Helen, one of the master's earliest, I believe, is likewise one of his best. The details are exquisitely painted. Helen looks needlessly sheepish, and Paris has a most odious ogle, but the limbs of the male figure are beautifully designed, and of not the green tone which you see in the later pictures of the master. What is the meaning of this green? Was it the fashion, or the varnish? Girardet's pictures are green. Gros emperors and grenadiers have universally the jaundice. Gerard Sitch has a most decided green sickness, and I am at a loss, I confess, to account for the enthusiasm which this performance inspired on its first appearance before the public. In the same room with it is Girardet's ghastly eluge, and Gericault's dismal Edusa. Gericault died, they say, for want of fame. He was a man who possessed a considerable fortune of his own, but pined because no one in his day would purchase his pictures, and so acknowledge his talent. At present, a scrawl from his pencil brings an enormous price. All his works have a grand catchit. He never did anything mean. When he painted the aft of the Medusa, it is said he lived for a long time among the corpses which he painted, and that his studio was a second morgue. If you have not seen the picture, you are familiar probably with Reynolds's admirable engraving of it. A huge black sea, a raft beating upon it, a horrid company of men dead, half dead, writhing and frantic with hideous hunger or hideous hope, and, far away, black, against a stormy sunset, a sail. The story is powerfully told, and has a legitimate tragic interest, so to speak, deeper, because more natural, than Girardet's green eluge, for instance. Or his livid Rhestes, or red-hot Clytemnestra. Seen from a distance, the latter's eluge has a certain awe-inspiring air with it. A slimy green man stands on a green rock, and clutches hold of a tree. On the green man's shoulders is his old father, in a green old age. To him hangs his wife, with a babe on her breast, and dangling at her hair, another child. In the water floats a corpse, a beautiful head, and a green sea and atmosphere envelops all this dismal group. The old father is represented with a bag of money in his hand, and the tree, which the man catches, is cracking, and just on the point of giving way. These two points were considered very fine by the critics. They are two such ghastly epigrams as continually disfigure French tragedy. for this reason I have never been able to read Rassen with pleasure. The dialogue is so crammed with these lugubrious good things, melancholy antitheses, sparkling undertaker's wit. But this is heresy, and had better be spoken discreetly. The gallery contains a vast number of Paulsen's pictures. They put Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.